Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court, William W. Palmer, appearing on behalf of Plaintiff Appellants and Consolidated Cases 07-17223 and 07-16902 in the Taylor v. Wesley case. Seated with me is my colleague, Daniel J. Culhane, who's also making an appearance. At the outset, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes to respond to the opposition. I'll keep this short. I have roughly a half dozen points, but in essence, here's what we've learned during the 7 years of this litigation. In short, the
we have heard and decided the prior cases, and what you now have at issue are the changes made by the State of California in response to your prior actions in which you prevailed. And show us now where Mullane v. Central Hanover Trust applies and where you feel that they are outside the range of constitutional reasonableness.
Your Honor, at the root, the State of California Comptroller's Office disputes that Mullane and Jones v. Flowers apply to the takings at issue at all.
Counsel, could you direct us to the sections of the statute that are responsive to Judge Beezer's question?
Yes, Your Honor. It would be Section 1531 of the Code of Civil Procedure, as modified by SB 86, which was a recently passed statute. The fundamental problem with that statute is that it provides only direct mail notice. It's sent to addresses that are stale addresses unless the owner happens to be a current California taxpayer. There is no viable safety net in the form of publication of names. The respondents or the appellee's brief is misleading, where they talk about publication. The only notice that they are providing is the same notice that this court expressly rejected in Seattle in July of 2007. As to publication, they are only providing generic publication that directs owners to a searchable website. That's the only
I must have missed something. I thought what they did before was nothing but a notice in the newspaper saying there was a website.
Correct.
No notice to individuals. And I thought this time they mail notice to the individual either at the last known address that the holder has or the tax address. Plus they have the notice in the paper saying there's a website, plus they publish the names on the website. Is that right?
Your Honor, the only names that are published on the website are in a searchable website. It's like a locked room. You have to go to the website, assume that you have lost property, and then search the database for your name. So your name will not pop up.
Are you saying there's a secret password that you need?
No, you have to go.
You said it was locked.
Well, you have, in order to enter the database, you have to go to a website, and then you have to begin entering your information into the website to look to see if you have had your property taken. In other words, it's not like traditional publication notice where the name is laid out for the public to see.
So what? Why does that matter?
It matters from the standpoint that it puts the onus on the property owner to search for the notice. It doesn't convey any notice at all. In other words, if you don't receive that direct mail notice, if you aren't a California taxpayer, and then you will not receive any notice. There will be nothing to tell you your property's been taken. You would have to say to yourself, well, I think I'll check the California website today to see if my property's been taken. In the traditional Mullane standard, they would publish that name in the newspaper, and it would give a description of your property, and it would be calculated to reach you so that even if you...
Why doesn't the mail do that?
The mail, Your Honor, if the mail... First of all, this process assumes that the only reason the property is being delivered to the state is that the holder does not have a current address for the property owner. So if the controller turns around and simply mails a letter to that address, they presumptively it's stale.
I thought the holder was obligated to advise the state if, for example, a stockholder had not cashed a dividend check for a period of time.
That's the criteria that they've used, Your Honor, to assume that the property's abandoned. They've created criteria to draw an assumption that someone's abandoned their property. One of the criteria that you noted in Taylor 1 is if somebody doesn't cash a dividend check, then they say, okay, that person's abandoned their property, and it's taken, and it's sold. When we appeared in Seattle, they were providing no notice at all beyond those generic ads in the newspapers saying we have unclaimed property. Now what they've done, and this does not meet the Mullane standard, is they're saying we'll send a letter to that presumptively stale address, but we'll back it up by checking the current California taxpayer roster.
I don't understand why the letter doesn't meet the Mullane standard.
Well, in the case, the reason that it doesn't meet the Mullane standard, Your Honor, is that there's nothing to back that up. There is no safety net of the publication notice below it. So if you do not receive that letter, your property's gone.
Do we know what counsel is it? Counsel, is it your expectation that California is required to publish in every newspaper all over the world to find people that are living in Hong Kong or Tibet or wherever it may be?
Well, my problem from the outset with this. I'm sorry, Your Honor, I didn't let you finish.
Is that the notice you want given or think must be given?
The notice that we believe should be given is nothing less than the Mullane constitutional notice. If I have an address that comes to me from
that gives you absolutely no force with me. I mean, we're deciding whether it's the Mullane notice. Mm-hmm. You telling us that it isn't doesn't show us that it isn't. I'm curious about the answer to Judge Beeser's question.
I will give you the answer, Your Honor. If I have an address of a person in England, for example, I'm taking his property, and the address is in England, or is in Arizona, or is in Seattle, Washington, and I know that that citizen is not going to get proper Mullane notice, that I'm just going to send them a letter, and presumptively the address is already stale, that person will have no opportunity to claim their property. If I were the California controller, right at the outset, I would say to myself, why am I taking property from a man in England? Why does he fall within
England?
I apologize, Your Honor. Couldn't you?
You know the property is in England.
Because on the
controller know it's in England.
Because the addresses from the holders indicate where the person is located. As you said a moment ago, Judge Beeser, that's how they know the person's in Hong Kong. It has a Hong Kong address on it.
Do they have to publish in a newspaper in England?
My position on that, Your Honor, would be why are they if I can't assure that that person's going to get constitutional notice, I should not be taking that property.
Could you quit talking about the law for a minute and talk about the facts? Do they have to publish in England or don't they?
They do not, Your Honor. In the case of they do not have to publish in England. Under the current law, they would simply send a letter to the last address. The man in England obviously would never have paid taxes in the state of California.
Are you saying that now we get back to the law. Are you saying that under Mullane they're required to publish in England?
They would be required to assure that they used the means of someone actually desirous of reaching that person in England, okay? If they're going to take property from someone in England, then they're going to have to follow a process that protects that citizen in that other state or country. It could just as well be a person in Arizona or a person in the state of Washington.
Where should they publish? You're saying that what's defective about the new statute is it does not require publication in a newspaper in the traditional way. What newspaper should they publish in, or do they have to publish in, what newspapers?
Well, if I were the controller, they could publish in the publications that would reach those people, general national publications or international publications if they wanted to go to that level. But there is a twist that where we could strengthen Mullane and this notion of publication, if they were to run the names in a format just in a newspaper, that will reach people in those other countries. It will, because we take advantage of the Internet. The problem with the controller's current method is they have everything in a website, in a searchable site. If they were to, for example, publish all the names in a newspaper, that has the added advantage of reaching everyone in the world. It's not as in the old days where it would only reach a county.
I'm missing something here.
Yes.
I can, in a short list of names, like the Fairbanks North Star Borough property tax list, I can find my name pretty easily, alphabetically. But California is bigger than the Fairbanks North Star Borough. I would think it would be a lot easier to find my name in a database where I could just type in my name. What's the matter with that?
The defect there, Judge Kleinfeld, is that you would not know to go to that database. You would have to think to yourself, okay, I need to, it's yes, Judge.
Judge Hawkins has been trying to.
I apologize, Your Honor.
You don't need to apologize. My question is this. Do we know the numbers we're talking about, the percentage of people that with unknown addresses?
Well, the only reason
that might fall through the cracks.
Well, the percentage of people in other states and other countries, I would estimate in the range of 10 to 15% of the existing names. In other words, there's 8.7 million people, so roughly 1.2 million of those people who never received notice would be living in other states and other countries, roughly 15%. That would be of the existing pool. Now, on a go-forward basis, if California continues this process, then that same percentage in the future ad infinitum would continue to not receive any Mullane notice.
Do we know what the comptroller does when they get a letter back that says that the person's no longer at this address?
They will hold the property for a fixed period of time under their current law. That's 12 and a half months for stock, and then they will sell the stock. In the case of the contents of a safety deposit box, at the end of 18 months, they will auction the contents off on eBay, and they will shred the property that has no value. It will be permanently destroyed.
The letter comes back, and it says no longer at this address, but they've moved to address B. What does the controller do?
My understanding is under the current practice, they do no further follow-ups. There is only one letter mailed. It will be mailed to either the address that the holder provides, the company, which is presumptively stale, or they will go to the California tax roster. And if an individual happened to pay taxes in the state of California, they will have a new address, and they will mail a single letter to that new address. So, for example, if they had two questionable addresses, they would mail one letter. If they received the letter back, there's no follow-up.
Thank you.
So you're saying if they have two addresses, they only send one letter? If they get one address from the holder and one address from the tax rolls, they'll only send one letter?
No, what they do, Your Honor, is if they check the tax rolls in California, again, Judge Beezer and Judge Hawkins, if you had property come to the state of California and you hadn't paid taxes in the state of California, you wouldn't be on our tax rolls. But if you happen to be, then they would assume that the tax database is more accurate, and they would mail a letter to that address. They would not mail it to the old address provided by the holder, because they would presume it's stale, as they should. Over the last 7 years, we've talked about notice. The controller has never viewed the private property as held in trust, belonging to other people, and still doesn't understand his role as trustee. In fact, if you were to look at this last year's state comprehensive financial report for 2006.
Counsel, I'm trying to sort out something that applies to the argument you're making now. I'm trying to sort out the extent to which we should review this now as an as-applied challenge and the extent to which we should regard it as a facial challenge to the statute. And I'm inclined to view that through the lens of our standard of review for preliminary injunction. So the conclusion that tentatively leads me to is that we review the denial of a preliminary injunction for abuse of discretion, but it leaves open the possibility that a final injunction may need to reflect evidence you produce on the mailings in order to tailor the required notice. What am I missing?
Because on the facial challenge, on its face, Your Honor, this statute does not meet the constitutional threshold. If you do not put in place a injunction starting June 15th, they will begin selling off the property and destroying the property. So in the event that we're wrong, that in the event that in the end of this case, we prove on the merits that this was, the whole process was unconstitutional, that it facially the statute was defective, we will have sold in the range of $500 million to $1 billion in private property for however long this case takes. I see I'm down to 3-4 minutes, and I'd like to reserve the balance, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. Robin Johansson on behalf of the defendants. I'd like to try to answer some of the court's questions, and if I skip any, please remind me what they were.
I have an additional one for you on the appeal that's consolidated.
Yes, Your Honor.
Attorney's fees appeal. The judge denied attorney's fees because the case isn't over. However, when I look at the Supreme Court decision in I forget the name at the moment, unfortunately, Buckhannon, that's it. In Buckhannon, what we need to look for is some judicial compulsion that made the state do what it did, as opposed to the state doing what it did just in response to a threat of a lawsuit. They have to have been awarded some relief by the court. Now, it seems to me the only reason what we have to look at here is the plaintiffs won two decisions in the Ninth Circuit. And after the second one, that was a second reversal, they got an injunction in accord with our directions from the district court. Why isn't, and then they changed the statute. They didn't change the statute just because plaintiffs privately squawked, as in Buckhannon. Why isn't that somebody who's been awarded some relief by the court? And what's more, why shouldn't attorney's fees be awarded now? Because that part of the case is all over. There won't be any more litigation about the constitutionality of the prior statute now that the state's passed a new one. They won.
Your Honor, as to your first question, we agree that Buckhannon is not controlling here, and we have not argued that to the court. We agree that there has been a legal alteration in the relationship of the parties, and that under this court's precedence, involving preliminary injunctions that become moot, then eventually the plaintiffs as prevailing parties may be entitled to attorney's fees. The question is whether they are entitled to interim attorney's fees now, and whether under the showing that they made to the district court, they are entitled to attorney's fees. And as to
does that mean that if you win the substantive appeal, the merits appeal now, and we affirm the denial of the preliminary injunction, there will then be a final injunction or not, depending on whether the district judge thinks any further compliance measures are necessary, and then the plaintiffs will be entitled to attorney's fees for the work they've done up to the statutory change?
Yes, but that doesn't mean that they will be entitled to those attorney's fees as an interim award, as opposed to waiting to see the degree of their success on the entire case. That is a very different question. And while interim awards of attorney's fees are clearly within the court of, or the district court's discretion, we have found no case where a district court was reversed for denying an interim award.
You said two things just now. One is they're not entitled to interim fees. And the other is that whether they're entitled to fees, if I understood you right, for the work they did up to when the statute was changed, depends on what happens from here on.
The degree, yes, Your Honor, and it's because of the question of limited or partial success. Once this case...
I don't understand. Why wouldn't they get attorney's fees for what they did up to when they got the statute amended, and then they may have wasted their time subsequently?
Well, because the question is whether they're entitled to all of the attorney's fees that they're claiming, which involved taking these two appeals. Remember, on Taylor 1, Your Honor, there was a lot of question about whether they were entitled to retrospective relief. And this Court held they are not. But that hasn't fully been resolved in the Court below. They're still seeking damages. So the question of partial success is very much at issue here. And from the District Court's point of view, rather than trying to determine at this stage of the proceedings how much of what they did up to this point is in fact attributable to their success on the preliminary injunction, is something that would be...
As of today, the district court has denied all attorney's fees, right?
As of today, the district court has denied an interim award of attorney's fees.
The question that we're to decide when the prior cases were concluded, should the district court address the question of attorney's fees as an initial matter then, right?
That's the issue, Your Honor.
It's over. Okay, well then, why shouldn't we remand back to the district court and tell them at the conclusion of the prior cases, as of that date, fix an attorney's fee if one is to be awarded?
If I'm understanding Your Honor's question correctly, by the prior cases, are you referring to the Court's first opinion in Taylor 1 and then the second opinion in Taylor 2? Or, I'm sorry, I don't understand.
Water over the dam.
Yes, and
all that work has been done and it's been concluded, and time goes on and the state hangs on to the money. And the lawyer's funding this lawsuit.
Well, Your Honor, and the issue is
going on.
I think the issue is whether there is a right to an interim award as opposed to an award at the conclusion of the lawsuit. And that's a case.
Right, the critical thing, I thought it was all discretionary.
It is discretionary, Your Honor, and as far as we can see, there's no right involved. There, the fact that we cited all these cases about interim awards not being...
Well, if it's discretionary, then we would review for abuse of discretion, is that right?
Correct. And
we could say, well, we could go either way on that, couldn't we?
I'm not sure you could under these circumstances, Your Honor, because of the...
Is there a right not to pay an interim attorney's fee?
Not that I know of, Your Honor, but the question would be whether there are guidelines that are appropriate for the district court to exercise in deciding whether or not an interim award is required.
The plaintiff doesn't have a right and the state doesn't have a right. We just review discretion.
As far as, well, Your Honor, the traditional rule is that attorney's fees are awarded at the end of the case, once it's clear what the degree of success has been. So interim awards are the exception rather than the rule. So then the question becomes, what guidelines would this court issue for district courts?
It seems kind of obvious that we whip the state of California around the head and shoulders to the point where they passed a new law.
I'm sorry. The question would be then, what about the rest of the case? And how much of the effort that went into drafting the complaint, having that first appeal, taking all of the other issues that the plaintiff's attorneys have spent, they say, 7,000 attorney hours working up. How much of that is reasonably attributable? I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Counsel, my problem is this. The work has been done, a result has been obtained, and you say the district court has no obligation whatsoever to even look at his fee application and make a decision as to whether all or part or any part thereof should be awarded and paid by the state of California. And you say that nothing has happened. Well, plenty has happened. The Office of Forfeiture has completely changed its rules and regulations pursuant to a statute. So there's been a result obtained. Now, whether 7,000 hours were necessary to do that, that's for the district court to take testimony and decide on the basis of expert witnesses, affidavits, time records, and just the regular routine that you go through on an attorney's fee. But I don't see any impediment to an award at this time for the prior litigation before this case started.
And, Your Honor, I do not mean to say that nothing has happened. We certainly agree that the preliminary injunction has happened. We believe that the change moots the noticed issue. And we believe then that the district court can and should and will give us judgment on the current law as satisfying the constitutional requirements. Yes, Your Honor.
So Judge Hawkins is trying to answer.
Yes, I see. Thank you.
If we were all in the same room together at the conclusion of Judge Beezer's question, I would have said amen. But my question is this. At the start of your argument, you said you were going to respond to some of the questions that the panel asked and the responses that your opponent gave on the current operation of the program. Can you do that now?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. Your Honor, you asked what happens when a letter that we have sent, a pre-escheat letter, has been returned. And if an address is given, I would be very surprised. And here we are, you know, up here without actual testimony. But there is nothing that in the record to support Mr. Palmer's statement that we would not send to the new address, and everything to suggest that we would. In addition, what we have is the address going up, the owner and address and the property itself, up on the website immediately as backup notice for the owner, which puts us in the situation in Mullane where the court talked about where the address and the owners are unknown, publication is sufficient. So that's what we're doing. I can give the court, again, stop me if you would prefer me not to get into matters that are extra record, but I do have a little bit of information about the number of pre-escheat notices that were returned as of the end of February. We had sent out 595,841, and of those, 75,612 were returned. I don't have any information for the court about how many of those had other addresses. But
does the new statute require, or do the current practices of the comptroller envision publication in a newspaper of general circulation in the state where the person last resided, if that's not California?
No, Your Honor. We are not. If by publication the court means a list with names and addresses, the statute does not permit that. We do publish the what we call generic ads informing people about how they can contact the controller's office and how they can go onto the Internet. And those are published widely. I don't have the figures for where they are published, but we do not publish the actual names and the address in newspapers. And in the record, you will find the evidence that we put in about, from the census, about how newspaper circulation is shrinking, while at the same time, Internet usage is growing by leaps and bounds. The other issue, and I think one of the judges raised this, I think Judge Kleinfeld, the question of the millions of names, the difficulty for someone being able to find his or her name, particularly if it's a common name, in a list of millions or hundreds of thousands or tens of thousands.
You could put them in alphabetical order.
Well, yes, Your Honor, we certainly could. But the size of the print...
The computer will do it for you. That's really easy to do because it treats the letters as ASCII numbers. I'm thinking... I was trying to think, why could it matter? And I was thinking, if my name showed up in the borough property tax list, other people would kid me because they'd seen it there about not paying my property taxes. Somebody else might notice it. But if it was just a database where I had to look for my name, they wouldn't notice it and kid me about it. And also, if it could vary according to whether it was A. Kleinfeld or Andrew Kleinfeld or Andrew J. Kleinfeld, database might say no such person because I typed it a little bit differently. Or it could be that the clerk at the S-Cheat office misspelled my name, as a lot of people do, and wrote it Kleinfield instead of Kleinfeld, and then I would never find it.
Well, Your Honor,
is there any way a person would be likely to get tipped off if any of those things happened?
Yes. If you were to go onto the controller's website and type in your name, you will come up with variations on your name as well. So that if it is misspelled, your name will come up. You'll get a list, a whole bunch of names, particularly if you just use the last name. So that is there. The other thing, of course, about newspaper publication is that it's a one-time only deal, whereas the website is there constantly. Any time of the day or night.
Three times, actually.
Well, yes, Your Honor, but I mean, it's chance alone, as the Mullane Court talked about, brings that to somebody's attention. Whereas with the website, it's there, it can be searched from any place in the world. So that the chances of someone in England, for example, being able to find whether or not he has property that is being held by the state of California are much greater.
I guess since you don't have to pay a newspaper's rates or pay for paper, you could add an alphabetical list at a nominal expense to the state of California, couldn't you?
I'm sorry, I'm not sure what I understand. What you mean by add an alphabetical list?
A searchable database. You could have a list just like you'd find in the newspaper on the California.
Oh, I see. It would be a very, very long list. Whether one could get.
Is that a problem? I mean, it's just electronic.
No,
bytes.
I don't believe it is, Your Honor. And I don't know, for example, whether one has the ability even now to go onto the website and simply download the whole thing. I can't answer the court's question. We do have one other thing, Your Honor, that I think the court should be aware of, and that is that, you know, there's a whole industry of people who are what are called air finders, who search these lists on a regular basis and then contact people themselves. So they charge a fee where we tell people, you know, you don't need to pay anybody to get your property back. But if the court were to go on to the list and look for, you know, your friends' names or whatever, which people do, that's another way that the word gets out. So the searchability of the website, in our view, is a much greater advantage over what we did back in the late 80s and early 90s, because it has the ability to reach so many more people. We had over a billion visits to the website in 1 year. That's very, very different than just publishing something that people may or may not see. Mr. Palmer said that there are 15% of the names in other counties or countries. Excuse me. I have no basis for that. There's no site. There's no evidence in the record about that. The question I think that you, Judge Kleinfeld, raised with Mr. Palmer about whether we're dealing with an as-applied or with a facial challenge here goes directly to this question of what kind of evidence should the court use to decide the legitimacy of our particular notice requirements. And if the plaintiffs can produce evidence that an as-applied challenge means that a significant group of people are somehow being injured, then I think the court has to look at what does Mullane require. And if I may, just Mullane talked about the reasonableness standard as being the criterion is not the possibility of conceivable injury.
You told us a few minutes ago that out of 600,000 notices, or a little less, by the end of February, about 75,000 were returned.
Correct.
That's about one-eighth. That means about one-eighth of the notices do not reach the owner of the property. Is there anything besides the searchable database for that one-eighth?
Well, Your Honor, at this stage, what we have then after are what Mr. Palmer has wrongly characterized as an 88-person locator unit. The locator unit is actually four people and a manager, but they do go out and they are trying to locate people, and they are working working manually, as we would put it, to find people. The fact that the notices have been returned means that our notice did not reach that person. But remember, we also have the holder's notice, and we don't know necessarily whether or not that notice reached the person, and the person simply ignored it. So in the sense of that 75,000, we have now, with those people, we are in the position that the state of Georgia was in Jones versus Flowers. And it was there that the Supreme Court said, okay, once it's been returned and you know it wasn't delivered, your notice wasn't delivered, what reasonable steps do you have to take? And the court expressly said, you are not required to look in the phone book, you are not required to look in the tax rolls. We have already done that with the tax rolls where we can. So we are going way beyond Jones versus Flowers. Now, I'm running out of time, but I would ask the court also. Pardon me?
Actually, you're over your time.
I'm over my time. Could I ask the court, please, to take a look at one case that we did not emphasize as we should have, and that is a post-Mullane case that discusses Mullane in the context of a permanent escheat.
Time. Go ahead and give us the name.
All right. Standard Oil Company versus State of New Jersey, 341 U.S. 428, says that publication notice is adequate for a permanent escheat program. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel.
Quickly to respond, the cases have already addressed. As to the fee question, that's answered in the Hensley case, which is Hensley and Hanrahan. The purpose of the interim fee was to allow the plaintiffs to complete their case. Judge Shub, the district court, erred when he held we were not a prevailing party. I think that's undisputed. The quote is, accordingly, a prevailing party, quote, should under ordinary circumstances recover attorney's fees unless special circumstances would render such an award unjust. And that's Hensley quoting Newman versus Piggy Park Enterprises, 390 U.S. 400-402, 1968. Your Honor, from a practical standpoint, Congress intended the interim fee provision to allow us to prosecute complex civil rights cases. If there were no interim fees, one solution would be the case would come down, I'd talk to my clients, and that'd be the end of the litigation because we couldn't afford to push forward. So that's the fee issue. There were a number of misstatements that I need to be very clear on. What we're asking for is publication notice. Traditional Mullane publication notice. There is, as you noted, in the Taylor 2 decision, and I can give you the cite to your own decision. I don't mean to read back your words. There is no authority for a searchable website. Now, there were a number of misstatements. Judge Hawkins, you asked about publication. As each of us in this room knows, once the names are published in a newspaper, they're on the World Wide Web forever. You can go and you run your name, you'll see the articles that list you going back years. So if the state published the names in the traditional Mullane format, as I mentioned at the beginning, they would have the added benefit of the Internet. It wouldn't be just a single-day publication. The published names would remain on the Internet forever. There were misstatements about the searchable website. Judge Kleinfeld, you asked about spellings. And my colleague, and I know she didn't mean this intentionally, said that it would pull up different variations of your name. That's not accurate. Okay, the state auditor, and this is part of the record in front of the court, noted that the controller has at least three different databases, that not that they were 3 years behind loading the documents onto their website, that they had microfiche, that they had books with records in them. And in the case of Mr. Lusby Taylor, he had two accounts, one in the name Chris Lusby Taylor, all run together, and the other in the name Taylor Chris Lusby, all run together. If he ran the name Taylor from England, he wouldn't have picked up either accounts. The only reason he found his accounts in California is that another man from England, Stephen Tucker, who's a plaintiff in the Seaver case, Judge Hawkins, happened to see Mr. Taylor's name misspelled in all the other Intel shareholders when he was looking for his and called up Mr. Taylor in England and said, you've got stock here in California too. Any typo in your name, or if you, for example, owned a corporation and you were looking for your corporate assets, they wouldn't be under your name. Now, at least, Judge Kleinfeld, as you noted, if it's published in a newspaper, which would then be posted on the World Wide Web, you might pick up a Google alert or a Yahoo alert, but at least you'd have a shot at getting your property.
Why couldn't they skip the newspaper and just publish the alphabetical list on the web?
I think that's what that
you'd be telling us. The virtue of publishing the whole thing, say in the Contra Costa Times, is the Contra Costa Times would itself post it on the web.
That's
and
right.
And it would stay there. Why couldn't the California Comptroller's Office just put it on the web?
If I wanted to take a shot, I could say yes, they could. But I'm staying within the United States Supreme Court precedent, where I know that traditional publication.
One thing Mullane did not say is that publication on the web was inadequate, there being no web at the time.
Correct, Your Honor, yes. But we did have the Jones versus Flowers case. We never got into this web discussion. I'm simply saying that if they just do the traditional publication in a California newspaper, we will get, assuming they do it properly, as you noted, posting all the names then we will get the added benefit of the worldwide internet to reach people in other countries. As it stands now, the only thing they do are those generic ads saying you should check a searchable website. And I put in the record the California State Auditor's Report that says that large categories of property are not posted at all on that World Wide Web. So, for example,
thank you,
sir.
Counsel, you've exhausted your time, so unless my colleagues have further questions, I think we've completed the argument.
My colleague went over by one. Can I just have 1 minute to conclude?
In 30 seconds.
Okay. Thank you, sir. I'd like to emphasize the urgency here. On June 15th, the state of California will ramp up this process. They're going to begin shredding documents and destroying property. I had a client, Gary Kesselman, who wanted to be here. He's dying of cancer. He will be gone in 30 days. The majority of those 8.7 million accounts belong to people over the age of 60 who do not know how to work the internet, who are in that area that we call the digital divide. People who do not use the internet would pick up the traditional newspaper publication, but you're dealing with elderly people, impoverished people, people who don't have the educational opportunities that we have. They would have the shot of the publication notice, but they are in that area of digital divide where we have a 60% penetration of the U.S. population on knowing how to use this internet, 40% doesn't know how to use it. And that argues in favor of the traditional Mullane publication notice, backed up by this new advances in the internet. Maybe someday it'll be appropriate when we have 100% penetration. Thank you, sir.
Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Taylor versus Chang is submitted. Court is adjourned.
If you clear the courtroom and tell the COs outside that the courtroom entrance is barred from entry, please.